I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Senate Majority Leader, the Democrat Harry Reid, says he'll make a final push to repeal the military's don't ask, don't tell policy during the lame duck session of Congress after the November elections. But the question is, will Reid be one of those lame ducks? He's in a dead heat right now with Republican and Tea Party favorite Sharon Angle, who was cast as a crackpot for her views on ending Social Security and the Department of Education, but is backed by the huge machinery of the Tea Party Express, run by the same California consultant Sal Russo, who helped put Scott Brown in office in Massachusetts, and people are taking Sharon Angle very seriously. Today we're going to take a close look at races in two states, Alaska, where incumbent Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has gone rogue, launching a write-in campaign against Sarah Palin-backed candidate Joe Miller. But first, let's start in Nevada. Las Vegas Sun political columnist John Ralston joins us. Welcome.
Hi.
And John, yesterday, as we know, Harry Reid tried and failed to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and also to pass the DREAM Act that gives a path to citizenship to undocumented immigrants who came as children but either attended college or served in the military. So did he maybe lose the battle there, but what, win over some voters back home?
Yeah, there's a lot of debate going on about that. Very difficult to tell whether or not this is a net win or a net loss for him. My view of it is very simple. Is Harry Reid's campaign is based.
Oopsie.
One of them is.
Oops, John. I just have to tell you, John. You're apparently a very popular guy. You're getting somebody. Somebody's trying to call you. So we'll wait for that. It's probably passed by now. So carry on. Your phone was dropping out a little bit.
I apologize.
No problem. No problem.
So Harry Reid's campaign is predicated on two things. One is destroying Sharon Angle with her own words, and you mentioned some of her positions they put on TV. But the other is to bridge the so-called enthusiasm gap to get Democrats to turn out in larger numbers. And so if there's a political calculation here or with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell and with the DREAM Act, it is part of that to energize the base. Now, it's clear that some people are, in the base are going to say, well, Senator Reid, if you can't get it done now and you're the majority leader and you have this big majority in the U.S. Senate, what's going to happen when you are likely to have a smaller majority? I still think it's a net plus for him in what he's trying to accomplish.
Well, some say that one thing he did accomplish was maybe pointing out the Republicans are obstructionist. But as you said, you know, people who didn't want to be, used in that way wanted him to pass it. Well, let's listen to what some of the candidates are saying. And Republicans have been turning out, as everyone well knows by now, the Tea Party Express has said that the Nevada Senate race is the most important one in the country for them. They've helped Sharon Angle raise millions, and that money's going into political ads like this one.
Illegals sneaking across our border, putting Americans' safety and jobs at risk. And what does Harry Reid do? He comes out opposed to Arizona's tough new immigration law. Harry Reid, the best friend an illegal alien ever had.
I'm Sharon Angle, and I approve this message.
To which Harry Reid responds.
Sharon Angle's new attack ad. More crazy talk and outright lies. This fence, it's Harry Reid who got 400 miles of new barriers. Remember, it's Sharon Angle who says she'd wipe out Social Security and Medicare. And Harry Reid who's protecting it for Americans.
I'm Harry Reid and I approve this message.
And John Ralston, Harry Reid says, Sharon Angle says crazy things. For outsiders, for people who've only seen, maybe Sharon Angle running away from the cameras or saying those things, what's going on? How is it that she's in a dead heat?
Well, there's a couple things going on. First of all, I have never in about 25 years of covering politics here experienced the kind of vitriol that is out there about Harry Reid for a variety of different reasons. He's been around for 40 years. The Democratic agenda is very, very unpopular, and he's one of the faces of it. I don't know how many times I've heard Obama read Pelosi this cycle and more to come. And listen, let's face it, he is not your typical skillful politician out there on the stump, and he's been known to say some fairly crazy things himself, to use his own word, that he says about Sharon Angle, including one that got some national publicity this week.
Well, let's tell people what it is, because he's called New York's junior senator Kirsten Gillibrand the hottest member of the Senate. And he also this week called Delaware Democratic nominee Chris Coons, who's running against the Tea Party-backed candidate Christine O'Donnell, his pet. He has had a couple comments of his own.
Yeah, and he it's listen. Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia said maybe the Angle can win if they send her to Bermuda for the rest of the campaign. I'm not sure which candidate would benefit more from being sent to Bermuda because they both have been known to say some fairly goofy things. But the reason that Sharon Angle is close is because of Harry Reid's negatives, which are sky high, and you have 35% to 40% of the voters, and that's of course a huge number, Robin, who I think would vote for Sharon Angle if she went out and committed a public felony instead of voting for Harry Reid. So Harry Reid's campaign is predicated on a very small number of undecided voters who he is trying to pull away from Sharon Angle by portraying her as extreme, but mostly using her own words. That campaign has been very successful and now creating essentially a dead heat or maybe a slight lead for Harry Reid, depending on what polls you believe. So she's in this race because there's a lot at stake here for the National Republican Party. They want to knock off the majority leader, so you have outside groups helping her to bridge an obvious funding gap with the Senate majority leader, who has unlimited access to funds. And American Crossroads, which is the group started by Karl Rove and others, has been spending millions here trying to keep the focus on the economy and Harry Reid's somewhat intemperate statements about his responsibility for the economy to try to keep her close. So far, that's worked.
And we should say, by the way, Sharon Angle is the former Reno State Assemblywoman. I want to make sure we've given her resume there. But you mentioned the outside groups. We're going to check in Alaska in just a minute, where Lisa Murkowski is trying to make much of outside groups like the Tea Party Express, which people are finding out more about this group, which is run by a Republican consultant, longtime consultant, but fronted by activists. And she's trying to position them as outsiders. Has any attempt been made to do that in Nevada, or do people not care?
Well, the only attempt that was made to do that was during the primary, when Angle's primary opponents, who were first thought to be the favorites in the race, Sue Loudon and Danny Tarkanian, when the Tea Party Express came in and helped Angle, pointed out some of the things that you mentioned, that it's being run by former Republican operatives, including Sal Russo, and essentially called it an arm of the establishment Republican Party, which, of course, is anathema to Republican primary voters this time. It did not work. The money overwhelmed them, and Angle won that primary fairly easily. It has not been a real issue in the general election because so many other issues have pushed that to the back burner. But Nevada has that Alaska doesn't have, though, is where they're having that write-in campaign for Lisa Murkowski, is they have seven other candidates and a none-of-the-above option, which every vote that is put into none-of-the-above this year helps Harry Reid, and that is part of his strategy. Even if you don't like me, even if you don't want to vote for me, you can't vote for the extreme woman, so vote for none of the above or vote for it. We actually have a Tea Party of Nevada candidate who is on the ballot who may get some votes and siphon some votes from Angle.
Right. John Ralston, political columnist for the Las Vegas Sun. Thank you, John.
My pleasure.
Well, as he said, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has launched a writing campaign after she narrowly lost her primary to Tea Party Express-backed lawyer Joe Miller. Today on the Today Show, she was asked about that campaign.
I am putting my state, the state of Alaska, before my party. And you know what? In today's political world, that's practically unheard of. People can't believe that I would do this, that I would make this effort, make this push. Why don't I just fade quietly into the sunset, as you say?
Well, that's what GOP lawmakers would like her to do today. Furious Senate lawmakers are stripping her of her powerful position on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Let's turn to Time Magazine congressional correspondent Jay Newton Small in Wasilla, Alaska, Sarah Palin country. And, there's also a Democratic candidate, Scott McAdams. You say Murkowski is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. People take gorillas in a room seriously. Are you taking Murkowski seriously?
It's hard to discount her when the other two candidates are spending so much of their time focusing their fire on her. Yes, it's a write-in race, which is incredibly difficult. It's never been pulled off in Alaska. It hasn't even been pulled off nationally in more than 50 years since Strom Thurmond. you know, won his Senate seat in Georgia. But, you know, she's got incredible name recognition in the state. So finding people who know her name or will be able to spell her name won't be that difficult for her. And, you know, there is a large sort of, I mean, the state is, as the Republican Party chairman here told me, is center-right. And right now, Joe Miller's, who's the Republican candidate who beat Murkowski, the Tea Party darling here, he has to prove himself as more center-right than just pure right. And
And Joe Miller has said, you know, he does represent Alaska. And you mentioned, her positions. Well, we've heard from listeners, one Matt Pender in Alaska, who says the national media is making, first of all, too much of Sarah Palin's influence on Joe Miller's race. He says the real problem is that Murkowski is resented because her father appointed her. Now, might this new fire in her belly maybe win over some of those people?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's overly... First of all, I think Sarah Palin had a huge impact on this. I mean, really, Joe Miller won this race, if you look at the county-by-county votes, because of the Matsu Valley, which is essentially Wasilla. So, that really, the turnout in this valley, where I am right now, is what won him the race. So I do think she actually had a very big impact on the race. And secondly, when her father, Frank Murkowski, appointed her to his old Senate seat, there was a lot of resentment. There was a lot of, you know, this is nepotism going on in Alaska. But since then, she's actually been a very effective senator. And she went into this race with her negatives were in the 20s and her positives were in the 70s. And they remain sort of, you know, her positives remain in the high 60s even after she lost, you know, the primary. So she is still a very popular figure here, and she's been a very well-respected, well-liked senator in the last few years.
Well, then there's the Democrat Scott McAdams. Now, the question is, do you think Murkowski will split the Republican vote or maybe take some votes from the Democrats? She is pro-choice, socially moderate. Now, there are far more Republicans in the state than Democrats, but do you see her also threatening the Democrat?
Absolutely, and I think that's part of her strategy. It seems is to reach out to that center, both on the Democratic voters and the Republican voters. And I think certainly when I was visited Scott McAdams' campaign offices in Anchorage, they were very worried about Lisa Murkowski. They were making calls to Democratic voters, saying, you know, trying to go over her record, saying, look, she's not a Democrat, she's not one of us, and they were. Certainly, she very much worries McAdams. She also has the support of the teachers union here, which also is very powerful.
Well, so where do the polls stand now?
Well, there has only been one recent poll. It was done by Dittman Research Group, and that was before the campaign or before the primary. But that showed Lisa Murkowski winning with 37% of the vote, and it's the only three-way poll that's been done with her and Joe Miller and Scott McAdams, and, you know, followed by Joe Miller with 31% and then McAdams with 24%. So that sort of poll is what encouraged her, pushed her over the edge and said, maybe I can win this, even if it is a write-in.
Well, and it's why perhaps you have a fascinating observation that you, at some of her fundraisers, you see high-powered Alaskan Democrats circling her. Might they try to convert her?
That's certainly, look, I mean, if she wins this by some miracle, I think Democrats are going to be looking very seriously at her. You've got the Republicans looking to kick her out of leadership, kick her off of her committees right now. And if she does win, she's not exactly going to be a happy Republican. Maybe they can convince her to come to their side.
Jay Newton Small, Time Magazine's congressional correspondent, speaking to us from Wasilla, Alaska. Jay, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. The man who brought us Al Gore in An Inconvenient Truth is now asking that people take action to improve public schools. Director Davis Guggenheim's new film is called Waiting for Superman. In it, we learn that every year over 1 million students fail to graduate from high school, that among developed nations, the U.S. ranks 25th in math, 21st in science. Here's Harlem Children's Zone president and CEO Jeffrey Canada in the film.
Kids look at the world and they make certain predictions based on the evidence they're receiving from their peers, from their parents, and from their teachers. From their perspective, the world is a heartless, cold-blooded place because they realize they've been given the short end of the stick and they don't know why.
Waiting for Superman mainly focuses on five kids who enter lotteries for the long-shot chance to attend charter schools. Here Now's Emiko Tamagawa sat down with Davis Guggenheim when he was in Boston recently. He told her that though he'd made a previous documentary following teachers throughout their first year, he didn't want to do another film about public school education.
It's a storytelling quagmire. You know, the public school system is so confusing and so full of thickets and wormholes that I don't think I could do it.
And this is something, and you're very honest about this in the film, you send your kids to private school.
That was a breakthrough. I had said no, essentially. In August, I was in Martha's Vineyard, actually, on the phone. I said, not, you know. And then I came back home to L.A., and it was first day of school, and I'm packing their lunches, and I'm shoes, backpacks. Like in the movie, I talk about this ritual that we all do. And I pack them in the minivan, and I start driving, and I start counting the schools. The public schools that I drive by. I was like, you know, I'm part of the problem. We're not going to fix our schools unless people like me change their behavior. Like, I'm doing what's right for my kids. But what about other people's children? How do I get people to care and fight for other people's children the way they care and fight for their own? And I have to start with myself. So I wrote, the first line I wrote was, every morning we do this. Every morning I drive past three public schools. I take my kids, betraying the ideals I thought I lived by.
One of the ways that you make this film accessible, you take a lot of information, and yes, there's a lot of cartoon information right. And ways of telling people statistics that are fun, but the heart of the film is the five kids.
I don't know what college I want to go to, but I know I want to be a teacher.
I want to be a nurse. I want to be a doctor.
How come?
Because I would like to help somebody in need.
Where did you find these kids, and what about their stories appealed to you?
It's actually impossible to find any family with kids that aren't in some way struggling to find a great school. It seems to be like that new inherited thing that you're, you know, no matter what neighborhood you live in. I wrote this in the movie, no matter what neighborhood we live in, each morning we take a leap of faith. You know, who's going to teach our children this morning? And so I wanted to look, I wanted neighborhoods everywhere. I wanted, you know, there's a little girl, Daisy, in East LA. There's an incredible boy in Washington, D.C., Anthony. And there's this girl in Northern California, white middle-class family. This family bought a house in a great neighborhood thinking the school would be great.
And, of course, they enter this lottery for a charter school that will improve their education. And one of the most powerful things that you do is you see that each of these children is entering a lottery, you know, how many applications there are for the school and how many openings. And it's really disturbing as you start to see how much the odds are stacked against these five kids.
Yeah, it's the odds are stacked against them. And as the movie goes, it's very suspenseful because the number of spaces tick down. And you're just on pins and needles hoping that Anthony gets in and Daisy gets in. You want them all to get in. I was at a screening last night, and I was taking this film, you know, in many different cities, and I had a woman come up to me and say, I have a charter here in Philadelphia, and I have over 1,000 people applying for 50 spots. That's how great the need is. There's families out there that are desperate for a great school, and we do not have enough great schools.
In this documentary, we see the teachers who have gone into the running of charter schools or who have gone into the management of teachers' unions. We don't see as many day-to-day teachers. Was that a deliberate choice?
It wasn't deliberate as much as, you know, I made that film. It was about, the first film was about how teachers are heroes to me. This was a film about the kids. This is about kids trying to find a great school and the system that the adults have built for them. And it really is kind of, Michelle Rhee has this brilliant thing. It's like, you know, oh, I get it. You know, the system has been built for harmony amongst the adults. It kind of works. You know, it's a great jobs program. People are set. Contracts are in place. But the end result is failing way too many kids.
Michelle Rhee, of course, is the chancellor of the D.C. school system. Another person who appears in the film, in fact, often appears at odds with Michelle Rhee, is Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers.
Right.
She has been quoted in news articles about this film. Her accusations, I mean, she has a couple of accusations, the probably the primary one being that it puts charter schools up on a pedestal and it demonizes teachers.
I made a decision that I would be tough on all the adults, starting with myself. You know, I'm tough on the centralized bureaucracy. I'm tough on the litany of politicians that have said I'm the education president. And I'm tough on the unions. You know, we're not going to fix our schools unless people who are in these entrenched positions, including myself, move off of self-interest and start putting kids first.
Do you see a day where you would be comfortable sending your kids to a public school?
Yeah, my wife and I talk about it every day. We talked about it last night. When we moved to our neighborhood, we're in Venice, California. We visited the neighborhood school. We looked at its scores, and it just wasn't there yet. And this May, we went back to visit that school, and they have a new principal and a new energy around that school. And our youngest will be ready next year, and we're hoping the school will be ready too. So, yeah, I mean, that's our dream, is to walk down our street holding her hand and walking her into our neighborhood school. That would be our dream.
Waiting for Superman director Davis Guggenheim, speaking with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. And this quick note, do you say relegate instead of delegate? Wrangle for wangle? Well, when I do it, I hear from you. Now we want to hear from you. Which words do you mangle? Go to hearandnow.org and tell us. And tomorrow, the American Heritage Dictionary will set us straight. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, undisclosed gems from country legend Hank Williams. You have to hear it here and now. It's become an annual event. Iranian President Ahmadinejad visits New York to address the UN General Assembly, and protesters line up against him. They include Iranian expats who plan to hold a rally across from the UN when Ahmadinejad speaks tomorrow. Among them will be a human rights activist whose parents were imprisoned in Iran after the revolution, then fled the country when Sahan Kashbanin was an infant. He's now a spokesperson for the No to Ahmadinejad Committee. That group supports the largest opposition group inside Iran, the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, or PMOI. And they're calling on the U.S. to lift its decade-old designation of the POMI as a terrorist organization. Sahan joins us now from New York. And Sahan, what else do you want to get across at the protest tomorrow?
Ahmadinejad does not represent the people of Iran. He was neither elected, nor do Iranians respect him inside the country and abroad. I mean, he represents the execution of over 220,000 political prisoners, you know, the brutal suppression and murder of protesters, including Netta, as you well know.
Well, let me ask you about that, because many people thought that the shooting death of that young Iranian Netta, who was killed during protests after presidential elections in June of 2009, many people thought that might be the tipping point, but it wasn't. The sort of, you know, movement in the streets fizzled out. Understandably, it was, you know, very violently put down. But if that didn't motivate this ground-up response, doesn't Ahmadinejad have the right to say he does lead the people because the people, you know, did leave the streets?
What happened last year, it's been going on for over 30 years, and it came to a boiling point. All these protesters that came out about a year ago, the judicial system carried out sentences calling them mahars. It denies them any form of judicial proceedings, and they are executed within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way Ahmadinejad's regime has kept itself in power is using these scare tactics.
Well, what do you think the answer is? If, in fact, the people were brutally put down when they rose up, if, in fact, even if Ahmadinejad is removed, you still have the conservative clergy that run the country. So what do you think the solution is?
Robin, I mean, in Iran, the politics works like this. You know, there is a supreme leader. His name is Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And whenever the, you know, false election system begins, he's the one that chooses who people vote for as a president. And as you can see, Ahmadinejad, who was selected by the clergy there, he represents, you know, brutal execution. I mean, Ahmadinejad was an executioner when he was in his youth years. I remember my father saying from my other uncles that they've actually seen Ahmadinejad torturing people within the prison cells. We want democratic regime change. We don't believe that anybody that is aligned with the Iranian regime has the ability to allow religious freedoms and allow political opponents. I mean, anybody who opposes the Iranian regime and the Islamic Republic's rules and commandments they are to be sentenced to death, not only them, but their entire family.
Well, you say you're calling for a democratic overthrow. What about external pressures? What about, for instance, the international sanctions against Iran? Now, Ahmadinejad this week described them as meaningless and ineffective. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to be showcasing a Philadelphia Inquirer report this week that reveals how an Iranian arms dealer was able to buy materials from American companies, some of them unwittingly, some knowingly. Do you agree that the sanctions aren't working?
The sanctions are working. I mean, we can see it because any time a tyrant comes out and denies the fact that something is affecting them, they're actually feeling the heat. And you can, we as Iranians, we can tell by the tone of their voice and their actions that they are coming under pressure. However, we as the Iranian community, we're saying that sanctions aren't enough.
Do you want the U.S. to consider war with Iran?
No, absolutely not. I mean, we're simply saying the United States should remove the obstacles and allow the Iranian opposition to take its natural, you know, progress towards a regime change there.
That's Sahan Kashbaten. He's a spokesperson for the No to Ahmadinejad Committee. They'll be protesting the Iranian president's speech at the UN General Assembly tomorrow in Manhattan. Sahan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. Have a good day.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and up next, defectors from North Korea tell of fear and the starvation that they left behind. That's in about 30 seconds, here and now. North Korea has announced that a rare conference of the country's Workers' Party will take place next week. Now, the last time there was such a meeting was 30 years ago, when the state's current leader, Kim Jong-il, succeeded his father, Kim Il-sung. And it's believed next week's meeting may be laying the foundation for another transfer of power, this time to Kim Jong-il's son, Kim Jong-un, a move that would preserve the Kim family's grip on North Korea into a third generation. Getting independent news from North Korea is very hard and rare, and almost nothing is known about the 27-year-old Kim Jong-un. But the BBC's China correspondent, Damian Grammaticus, traveled to the border to meet North Koreans who've recently fled their country. They paint a picture of a country in which the economy is in dire straits, hunger and starvation widespread, as is anger at the possibility of Kim Jong-un's taking over.
Standing on a bridge that links their country to North Korea, Chinese tourists pose for photographs, laughing and jovial. In the distance, you can make out dilapidated North Korean buildings. Everything looks crumbling and quiet. There's almost no sign of life. One tourist jokingly takes a step over a white line painted on the ground. The line marks the end of Chinese territory. He's shooed back by guards to more laughter. North Korea may be an oddity, peered at from outside. What's happening inside the secretive, isolated state is no light-hearted matter. Those who've recently escaped across the border speak of hunger and starvation returning to North Korea.
Recently, people started dying. If there's no food, people starve. It's like back in 1995, when people were dying everywhere. You see lots near the train stations. People without homes, they go there to sleep. Many of them die.
This woman, we'll call her Choi Young-hee, is in her 70s, a grandmother. A couple of months ago, she paid smugglers to carry her across the heavily guarded river that separates North Korea from China. Her daughter also tried to cross, was caught, and is now in a North Korean political prison. Choi Young-hee says food shortages mean well-off families in North Korea are getting two meals a day. Everyone else makes do with just one.
We don't ask to wear good clothes, to dance or play. We only want full stomachs. But every day we wake up and our first thought is how we are going to get some food for breakfast. Then how are we going to get something for dinner? Living like that makes people go crazy. Just brush against someone in the street and they will start fighting. In their hearts, everyone knows we live like dogs. Everyone thinks that, but no one can say it out loud.
Back at the Chinese border, shops sell North Korean memorabilia to the tourists who come to gawp through telescopes at North Korea. Military caps, postcards, pictures of its despotic leader Kim Jong-il. With conditions inside North Korea so desperate, many are willing to risk the border crossing in search of work and food. Lee So-ra, a 50-year-old mother of one, crossed late last month. She told us she saw people dying of hunger just a few weeks ago.
It's common for people to die of hunger. People just lie down in the street. They stay there for days and die there. Right before I came to China, I saw a person sitting outside of a public toilet. I said, "Don't sit here. Go to the entrance of the market. Maybe someone passing by will give you a candy or bread." They said they didn't have enough energy. 2 days later, they died, right there. There are many people like that. So weak, they starve to death.
On the Chinese side of the border, we drove along a muddy track winding along the river. Inside North Korea, Kim Jong-il is believed to be grooming his youngest son, Kim Jong-un, to take over to ensure power stays in the hands of the Kim dynasty. From a viewpoint overlooking a North Korean city, you can see tired old factories belching smoke, but no electric lights and almost no traffic on the roads. Disastrous economic policies have crippled the North's economy. 50-year-old Lee So-ra said she hopes the regime comes to an end. She fears more hardships if Kim's son, who's thought to be 27 years old, takes over.
Everybody is worried about it. We worry about how someone so young will be able to be our leader running the country. He doesn't have the capability. He's a person without experience or skills.
Such open, angry criticism of the Kim regime is something you would not have heard a few years ago. Choi Young-hee, the grandmother carried across the river and whose daughter is now in prison, is bitterly resentful about the prospect of Kim Jong-un taking power.
If we say anything about him being too young, we'll be arrested straight away. It makes me angry. I want to shout out loud. My daughter is going to die in prison. I want at least to scream and then die. But I can't because of my other children and relatives.
Video shot secretly inside North Korea shows a street market. There's hardly anything on sale. A few vegetables, some shoes. If Kim Jong-un takes over from Kim Jong-il, the inexperienced, untested young man who has no political legitimacy other than his birth will be at the helm of a nation with nuclear weapons, but a raft of difficult problems. Almost no real economy, widespread hunger, an increasingly desperate, alienated population, and tense relations with South Korea and America. Choi Young-hee speaks for many when she says she worries for North Korea's future.
If Kim Jong-il fed his people, even only with cornbread, we wouldn't complain. But he's made us die, lose our homes, suffer. If his son now takes power, I think it's dangerous. You wonder what will happen to North Korea. But inside my country, I can't say a word.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. If you are lucky enough to be within earshot of AM radio superstation WSM in Nashville at 7:15 in the morning in the year 1951, you are in for a treat.
The Millers of Mother's Best Flour bring you that lovesick blues boy, Hank Williams.
I got a feeling called the blues, oh Lord. Lord's handsome baby said goodbye.
Country legend Hank Williams on the Mother's Best radio show. Mother's Best Flower was the sponsor, and they paid Hank Williams $100 a week to sing his songs while listeners buttered their breakfast biscuits. And now, after barely escaping the trash heap of history, these wall-to-wall recordings of those performances will be available in a new collection, the Hank Williams Complete Mother's Best Recordings Plus. It holds a whopping 16 CDs, 72 15-minute shows, all packaged in a sort of a copy of a vintage 50s Atwater Kent table radio. If you turn the knob, it plays a Mother's Best commercial by Williams.
Just about the best way for you good Southern cooks to make sure your cornbread is perfect every time is to make it with Mother's Best cornmeal.
Joining us from the studios of Spotland Productions in Nashville is Hank Williams' daughter, Jet Williams, a country singer in her own right, but she's spent years putting this collection together. Jet, welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin. Appreciate you having me on the show.
And what was it like the first time you heard these?
It absolutely blew me away, not only because of these recordings we have never heard my dad sing before, but he also MCs the show, and you get to see what an all-around performer he is, from being able to tell jokes to set the songs up, his relaxed ease with the band and with the listener, and it's just absolutely precious.
Well, all of this music was found in the mid-1970s by Grand Ole Opry photographer Les Leverett. He rescued them from a dumpster during a cleanup at WSM. And as you said, they include songs you'd never heard Hank Williams sing. So name one of those.
One of the songs that we've never heard my dad, because he never recorded it, it was just that one live performance that day. An example is Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
Let's listen.
In the twilight glow I see her, blue eyes crying in the rain. As we kiss goodbye and parted, I knew we'd never meet again.
And also rescued in these recordings were some of the first-time performances of Hank Williams' classics that we have heard, but these would be the first time he'd ever perform them, one being Cold, Cold Heart. Let's listen to that.
A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
Boy, Chet Williams. You know, it's not just that you're hearing Hank Williams. He sounds fantastic.
What is really important, I think, about these recordings is, at first I thought old radio shows, they were going to be scratchy and, you know, spotty at best. But these are as if you turned on that radio and we took you back to 1951 and my dad was standing in the kitchen while you were baking those biscuits.
Well, and we also get this patter that we get to hear talking about songs like I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love with You. Let's listen.
We're awful glad to be with you again this morning, folks. We got a brand spanking new tune here that ain't never been sung on the air before, Lua. This is the first one. It's one called I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love with You. Today I passed you on the street and my heart fell at your feet. I can't help it if I'm still in love with you.
Jet Williams, I can't help it.
Help it.
This is your dad. You never got to meet him. He died at 29, just 5 days before you were born. What's it like to hear from him?
When you sit and listen to these Mother's Best recordings, it's like getting to visit with Hank. You know, he tells the jokes, you hear the relaxed manner, but then when you hear him sing those songs, and there's such magic because it is a live performance, and he truly sings like his life depends on it.
And for you, does this fill in some blanks for you, too, given, you know, he's your dad?
Oh, absolutely, because one of the songs he does, is he sets it up and he says it's the pop tune, but he's going to sing it the way his grandmama put him to bed. That's just a piece of family history for me, because I, you know, now I can see my dad as a child in the bed, his grandmother tucking him in, and, you know, singing on top of Old Smokey to him.
You know, Louie, there's an old song going around here that's one of the top pop tunes in the nation that my grandmother taught me, one of the first songs I ever remember singing.
What's that?
And I think all on top of Old Smokey.
Old Smokey.
You remember that thing?
Yeah, man.
Now, they didn't sing it the way she taught it to me, and back in them days, they didn't sing it like they sang it now.
No.
I'm going to get the boys and see if we can do it like the old, old-timers used to do.
All right, let's hear it.
They're going to join in on here. On top of Old Smokey, huh? Top of Old Smokey, all covered in snow, I lost my true lover by courting too slow.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if this is particularly important to you, because you have had some strained relations with Hank Williams Jr. Now, you each had different moms, although the same dad. Les Leverett gave you these recordings when he found them, and you and Hank Jr. had a bit of a battle over the rights. But then suddenly, a Texas company gets a copy. They want to put it out. The record company that owned the masters jumps in. They want to do something. So, in fact, this is your dad almost somehow coming back and bringing you two together, because you and your brother actually united over these recordings, ultimately.
You're absolutely right. We united together and stood together, and we were able to prevail and have the courts rule that the estate had clear title to these recordings. And we agreed to have these released because we wanted to share our dad's music with the world, and no better way to do it than together.
Mm. 16 CDs, 143 Hank Williams performances. As we go out, Jet Williams, do you have a favorite?
Well, I guess one of my favorites is I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry.
Yeah. We'll listen to that as we say thank you to Jet Williams, the daughter of country music legend Hank Williams and a country musician herself. The Hank Williams Complete Mother's Best Recordings Plus collection will be released on September 28th. Jet, thanks and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Robin. Thank y'all for your interest.
The silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
I'm so lonesome I could cry.
That's a good one. It's a lonesome song, ain't it?
Ain't that lonesome?
Ooh.
You can't get much lonesome.